Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Two fingers, four fingers, or chunky? What's your Kit Kat choice, Jesse Gomez?
It would have to be four fingers always. The more the better, I say.
Okay. Just milk chocolate? Are we talking about?
I prefer dark chocolate, to be fair.
You prefer the four finger dark chocolate Kit Kat? That is it's not the common the common selection, I say. Do you have any preference here, Matt?
It's two episodes in a row where I just chat about having gotten back from Japan, but I have brought everybody some green tea Kit Kats that I haven't brought into the office yet.
Oh, they're so good ones as
they
well.
They are very good.
Yep. Is that your pick then?
Green. I mean, if you can get them, this is just a bit of advice for if anybody goes over to Japan, but they're worth their weight in gold. Like you'll make friends by buying as many green tea Kit Kats as you can.
Absolutely. I'm firmly in the chunky camp. And the it's not even that funny. It's not laughing at me. I can see your face. You're making me laugh. Especially when they did like a special Lotus Biscoff one. That was incredible.
Oh, yeah.
The peanut butter one's good though as well.
I don't think they've done a dark chocolate one though, which is a shame.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, we've got a lot of different games things to talk about this week, so that's enough Kit Kat chat for now. It'll probably arise again. Who knows if I decide to bring it up. A bit of a bits and bobs episode this week. We're going to talk about lots of little things we've been watching and playing. But first up, I suppose we've got to talk a bit about this whole Xbox business thing, because that's all anyone's wanted to talk about 2 weeks, despite having zero information on any of it, which is funny, isn't it? Isn't it funny how rumors swirl out of control, Jesse, to the point where people actively look like they're gonna burn every piece of game console memorabilia they have?
I'm all for it, because it's sort of just a nice reminder and a good separation that, like, I know I'm normal. Like, I can be a bit terminally online.
I don't think you can know you're
times.
Normal. I think other people can say that you're normal. I don't think you can know.
I mean, I'd like to think I am, but it's just, you just see so much nonsense online. And I sound like an old man saying this, but I'm just like, I would say, like, go outside and touch some grass. But even I'm not bothered to do that. Just, like, sit on your sofa and watch a nice film, or just play a game. Just play a game and have fun.
Just don't worry about things that don't matter.
Yeah,
that's the main thing.
I think it was really important.
Broaden your horizons, please. Just enjoy things.
The stakes that people were talking about, like the absolute height of everything that could have been possibly bad about this, was like maybe some things were going to come to a different machine. And I don't own a PlayStation. I'll get that out of the way. Yeah. So I own an Xbox, and if anything was going to be multi-platform, I'll just play it on the box that I have. Like, where's the downside? And it turns out it was actually only going to be four games.
So. Exactly. I mean, four games for now, right? That they haven't officially revealed, but everyone's kind of pieced together that it's most likely Pentiment, Hi-Fi Rush, Sea of Thieves, and maybe Grounded. Like, they kind of, on that Xbox podcast, Phil Spencer led to, like, some breadcrumbs. For some reason, well, I know why they didn't announce it. It's probably because they write, like, other publishers, other, like, Nintendo or PlayStation have... are going to announce that at some point, so there's, you know, marketing beats to follow, etc. But the way they were teasing them was very funny. It's like, and I get why, like, these games would come to other consoles. Like, a game like Pentiment or Hi-Fi Rush, if those are the games, like, they've been out over a year, they're well-liked games we gave a 9 and a 10 to on IGN, respectively, and just, they've probably had their life cycle on Xbox, right? The people that have paid for those games or played them on Game Pass, because they're both on Game Pass, have enjoyed them. So why not put them on Switch and PlayStation, where you can A, make more money from people buying them, and B, more people can enjoy them. It seems a win-win, right?
Pentiment might even be a better game on Switch too, because I want to lie down and treat it like it's a little book. Like, why?
It might actually
be a better experience for the way of playing it.
I think this is all sort of leading to, because I saw that the current PlayStation boss said that, you know, first party PC games are also going to be like an aggressive growth plan for PlayStation. And I feel like all this sort of news where people are worrying that all these exclusives are, you know, coming to PC or coming to other consoles first, it's all sort of leading towards, in my mind, that sort of thing where, you know, like people even just a couple years ago or even 10 years ago, just like, just get a PC. Just do it and be done, because then, you know, you're going to be able to experience all the games there. And it's like, not to be a prick, but it's sort of happening. You know, like, it doesn't really matter what plastic box you have, as long as you can play the game. And cross-play as well is another amazing thing where, like...
It's all getting there, and it's all gradually been getting there anyway. Like, just like, for some reason, it's all blown up recently. Like, you've got Helldivers, that was PC and PlayStation day one.
Yeah, and that's fantastic.
PlayStation have been putting their games, whether it's God of War or, I can't remember, like, Uncharted games, Horizon, that have been trickling to PC after, what, a couple of years, once they've pretty much got all the PlayStation sales they're likely to get out of those. And to be fair, even Xbox have kind of historically done it. It's never a deal was made back because they were smaller games, like Cuphead and the Ori games were Xbox exclusives for like years at a time, and then came out on other things. Like, it's not the end of the world. It's not like, and Phil Spencer specifically said, Starfield, Indiana Jones, this is not happening. I mean, it's not happening day one. Who knows 5 years down the line if they're going to come to other things. But like,
it also,
it's just not that
best case scenario. It helps the development cost of first party titles, like long tail stuff that you like have probably already had their life. They come to another platform, they sell more copies, that in like makes the ecosystem better, that funds first party development. So the exclusive stuff that you want that is going to stay there will have more money to play with. Like, it actually makes it better.
It really is kind of win-win, I think. Especially, it's like, if you hold a game, like, Hi-Fi Rush is not necessarily... It's not going to set the world alight when it lands on PlayStation and or Switch if it comes out. Like, it'll sell some copies, but it's not going to be, like, millions and millions.
Maybe disagree with that, if only because it was kind of... It was a very good pitch for Game Pass. Like, Hi-Fi Rush was something that I maybe would have picked up, but it was I've already got Game Pass, this will extend the amount of time that I'm doing.
I mean, I think it'll sell copies, but it's not going to be, like, Spider-Man levels, is what I'm saying.
True. It's not like it won't move like a console, but I mean, it was an incentive to have Game Pass, which will be staying on Xbox. Like, that's the only argument I would make.
But like, they've also, it means they can drop the, like, they've got these games they're holding, right? And when there's like a lull during the year, like, I don't know, a month, I don't know, I can't think of a month this year where there's nothing coming out. For example, say it was June, they can just go, all right, there's nothing coming out on Xbox, nothing coming out on PlayStation, let's drop Hi-Fi Rush on PlayStation, and we might get quite a few sales there. Like, to me, it's quite smart from Xbox. It's nothing to really have a meltdown about, despite a lot of people having a meltdown about, and now retracting their meltdowns and finding new meltdowns to have meltdowns about. So
that's the thing. I do think it's sort of like a lot of the big response you see online, at least in my eyes, is that, you know, it is that sort of very, very vocal minority, because I feel like there must be the majority of
it's
people.
It's
like,
driven by people looking for engagement, either retweets on their blue tick Twitter accounts to get a few pennies in their pockets, or YouTubers looking to get ads. Like,
that's what I like to imagine. Like, 90% of people who own these consoles, like, just like, oh, the new PlayStation is out, the new Xbox is out, I'll buy it, I'm going to get FIFA, COD, whatever game I want, and they just don't care about being online and they just play shit. Exactly. That's who I like to think exists.
You talk to anyone, you're in a pub, talk to a random person who's just like, oh, I like games. They won't have a clue what's
check
been going
Pentiment
on about this. yeah, exactly.
Get Pentiment played.
The hit multi-platform game. Anyway, just thought we'd touch on that because it's been big news, right? And yeah, it's got to be, you know, talked about. So yeah, also they did confirm new hardware will be coming. That was a rumor that Xbox were just gonna, I don't know, chuck all hardware into the furnace and no one could ever use it again. But they confirmed new hardware coming. I think Phil Spencer even said it's the biggest leap the next generation will be ever between consoles, which seems a bit of a stretch, considering I don't even think games are really pushing the limits of the consoles we have now, so I don't know where that's coming from. And can it be a bigger jump from 2D to 3D? I'm not sure, but
you're gonna
we'll
be able
see.
To smell
we'll
games.
Yeah, VR is back. No.
Who knows? But anyway, let's talk about some actual games we've been playing. Persona 3 Reload. Matt Jones, you've been playing it. I'm holding off on it just because I only did play Persona 3 this time last year and I don't need to replay it again. But
was that
how
are
you
finding
it?
Time playing Persona 3?
It was my first time playing Persona 3.
So this is also my first time playing Persona 3 as well, which I think it's weird going back after having played 4 and 5, because it seems like playing it is just an experience of all of the complaints that people probably would have had.
It's a stripped back version of 4 and 5, right? It's kind of, it doesn't have all of the bits that make it extra, like, it's a much more, despite being still like 60 to 70 hours probably long, it is stripped back. There is a lot, like, you know, if you don't know the rough gameplay loop of Persona games, it's, you know, fighting demons at night and during the day, hanging out with friends basically to build relationship bonds to boost up your party's attack powers essentially. And it just feels like during the day, during Persona 3, from what I remember, you only really got like two options. There's not really a lot you can do. Whereas like in 4 and 5, you're kind of like inundated.
You are overwhelmed in 4 and 5 of stuff that's a possibility. Yeah.
3 Reload in that case is probably a good entry point for people, despite I think 5 being the best and 4 being the second best. Like 3 is the third best. But yeah, maybe you can explain, like, are you enjoying it?
I am.
Is what I'm trying to ask, basically.
I think that the, like, the main loop right now of going into a dungeon and then, like, messing around and, you know, just attacking things, and like Persona's core gameplay thing of trying to figure out what type an enemy is weak against. But that will use up all of your mana. So you don't want to, you want to use that sparingly. You basically want to guess correctly as often as possible. Because after you run out of mana, there's really only a few ways of getting it back, and then you'd have to leave. And you only really want to go into the dungeon a couple of times because the clock is constantly going forward. So you've got this like push and pull of, I don't want to fight too often because if I do, then I have to leave. And then if I leave, I won't be able to go on a date with somebody from the student
council.
That's
the most important thing.
Right, totally. I just don't have enough time to do all the stuff that I want to do. And that feeling's good. It really has that. But I feel like because I think 4 is my favorite. I like that a lot more than 5. Because it feels like you're just in this tight-knit group of friends. And Persona 3 doesn't really have that. I've heard them described as like co-workers before. And it kind of does feel like that.
You don't ever quite feel like, you don't ever, I like the cast of 3, but 4 and 5 are definitely much stronger cast. Like, you don't ever feel, like you said, like, there was never one person in 3 I was like, oh, you're my, but like, you're, it's me and you till the end sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Like, we're all like, we're getting the job done, like, sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I think Junpei's cool, right? Like, I think he's funny. But yeah, no one else is really, like, doing it for me. But I think it's that, like, in 4, the social links are the people that are in your party. So you're inevitably having to spend more time with them and learning who they are. Whereas the social links in this one, at least so far, you do have a couple, like, scenes with them. But it's mostly just people that are in the town. And some of them are pretty cool, but it doesn't feel like it's helping me feel more engaged, like, with the people that I'm hanging out with.
No, it still has... It's definitely, in my eyes, not as good as 4 and 5, but it's still, I think, very fun, very good. It has that still that core Persona loop that just keeps me coming back, and I will probably play Reload again. And the story is good, and it's just like the dark. This is definitely darker than 4 and 5, I think, tonally wise, especially the way you just go into the other multiverse in this game is just by shooting yourself in the head.
Sick. But.
Yeah, or is that how you summon your persona? I can't remember.
It's all about people in the town just being so miserable that they collapse as well, which is just like same.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. And it has like as all these games do, just like a batshit crazy ending. So I'm sure you'll enjoy that.
Yeah.
Like, for someone like me who is historically not an anime person, I do for some reason really connect with these games because they do go full batshit anime towards the end of them that I'm all in.
It's, I think, a year of, at least so far, pretty good, but like a little bit disappointing RPGs. So, like...
Not enjoying Infinite Wealth like you thought you would.
Infinite Wealth is not quite as good as Like a Dragon, if only because I don't think it would make... I think the combat system's great. Like, I feel like the knockback in this and, like, moving your character around so that you can position everybody is, like, is really cool. I way prefer playing it, but I just don't think it all ties together quite as well.
I think that's the... Yeah, I enjoy... Like, I think I'm similar with you. I enjoyed playing Infinite Wealth, much more than I enjoyed playing Like a Dragon. But yeah, the story, I think it's because it's Branch, obviously, it has kind of two protagonists this time around with Kiryu coming back. Like, it kind of does suffer from that a little bit. You're split between them a little bit. And
it just feels kind of messy. It's like, what's it actually about?
I still really loved it. But I know it wasn't as focused. I do think, though, I'm sure you'll finish it. Like, towards the end, there's some fantastic stuff.
Yeah, so, I'm well up for it. I'm in, like, chapter 11 now. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, I've got ending ahead of me. I've done all of Dondoko Island.
All in one go, like, one six-hour stretch. I just did it.
Well, you, like, unlock people. The same thing happened to me during the business management game in the last one. Like, you keep unlocking new employees that you could have in that. And I'd done it all in one sitting. And then I was like, oh, you can have this person work for you. And it's like, well, what's the point? I've already finished it. Same thing I imagine must happen for Dondoko. If you'd like do it all at once, it'd be like, oh, you can have Brad Pitt come to your island.
Yeah. It's very funny.
I kind of want to know, just because the first Persona game I played was Persona 5, and that was really my first proper, I don't know, delving into a turn-based RPG that's, you know, a quadrillion hours long. But what I see Atlus doing is that it just seems like Persona 3 Reloaded seems to draw like really heavily on just stylistically and maybe mechanically. Persona 5, like because obviously you haven't played Reload, Cardi, but Jones, you've obviously played it, but not played the original.
Is it? They've borrowed 5 a bit, I think. But I think as far as I know, the gameplay still like 3 was.
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly the same. I remember like in the original 3, which I hadn't played, but you can't control the rest of the party members. Like you can only control your character, which is different in this one, and I think the portable as well. So it is different from how it was originally released. The menu design is gorgeous, though.
Yeah.
Some people saying that like it's a little bit too bright, like the game is kind of dark tonally, so it should be darker.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't mind because it just looks really good. I will occasionally like flick through the menus and just like watch everything kind of snap in the same way that I did with 5.
Persona 3 Reload is like sold really well as well. Like it's already a million. Like it means they probably will do 4 next.
I can
imagine totally
it'd be good too. Like I think that 4 is great, but there's a lot of stuff that you could do to make it just utterly like utterly
I've already played through that game twice. And it's still like I played it when they re-released it on PlayStation and Switch. Was that last year or the year before? Mm-hmm. That was early last year, wasn't it? And still, it looks fine. It doesn't look dated. But like, if it looked like Persona 5, then yeah, it would be amazing. But I'd like, because I'd prefer if they went back to 1 or 2. I don't know too much about 1 or 2, but I'd love to play it.
They're all about like, it's a first person, but like grid-based thing.
Yeah, I don't know if they'd be able to restyle it in the modern Persona combat, or if that's, just make 6.
Which one lets you fight Hitler, or is that Shin Megami?
That's 2. Yeah, pretty sure that's 2.
Yeah, get that one going then.
Yeah.
Yes, good start to the year for JRPGs anyway, isn't it? We've got Final Fantasy coming out soon. Yeah.
There's Unicorn Overlord on the way as well, which I cannot wait
for. I've got half an eye on that. I'm not fully in yet, but I will.
Previews came out for it yesterday, and it looks absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, good time for RPGs. Something old, though, that's also been remastered, Jesse, that you're actually experiencing for the first time, I think, is the original 3 Tomb Raider games. You've been delving into Tomb Raider a lot the last couple of weeks because there's this new RTX remix version of it, and there's the remastered, the official remastered one coming out. And what one? I mean, what's your takeaway? Like, is Tomb Raider aged well?
I'm on the verge of saying no, and that's the thing. The weird thing about this sort of job is that if you've not played, you know, any of these games before, because I mentioned RTX Remix, you know, in the last podcast, and that was my first time playing Tomb Raider properly. And you sort of get introduced to like what the expectations are of the fan base and just how much they obviously love those games. And playing through it, I just don't think it's aged particularly well.
It won't have. It will control badly. I can tell you that now.
Yeah, I mean, it is a 3D platformer.
I remember
from
trying
the late 90s.
When I was like 12 in 2004 that it had aged badly. It didn't feel good to play then.
You're playing it on PC, presumably.
Yeah. I'm playing it on PC, but I'm using a Xbox One controller.
There's a really famous video from, I think it's from Fitz Thistlewitz, where they talk about how originally you had to control it with Control and Alt, so you were constantly always at threat of pressing the Windows key.
Right.
Like, imagine doing that now.
I mean, that sounds awful, but yeah, I think I've played maybe 2 or 3 hours of Tomb Raider 1. I would like to finish the trilogy to give it a proper go, just because I don't think
you need to if you don't want to.
Well,
you
no, really it's like I'm still
I've never finished all 3 of them.
I'm still trying to find out whether or not I am enjoying these games. And when I was streaming it, I was having a good time. I was making use of the modder controls, which I would say is a mistake if you're delving into the remaster, which is a shame because Tomb Raider, like, you know, Resident Evil before, it had sort of, you know, it uses tank controls, right? And Tomb Raider is very much a grid-based game where it's very sort of precise jumps, almost rhythm game-like when you're actually doing those platforming sections and stuff. But the modern controls sort of, as you would expect, changes it so that you can just use the analog stick and, you know, Lara can just move in any sort of direction. But that it's at extreme odds with how the game was inherently designed. It just doesn't work because then you have this sort of expectation in your head of, well, now I can sort of play it like Uncharted, or I can play it like a more recent Tomb Raider game, or even the Tomb Raider Anniversary Edition that came out like on the PlayStation 2 a few years afterwards. But it's just, it's a very precise and clunky platformer, and adding modern controls that don't quite work, and then the camera's getting caught in the environment, it's not fantastic.
It doesn't sound ideal, no. I mean, there's only two things you need to do in Tomb Raider, in my opinion, is A, get the butler in the freezer. That's the one thing.
Yeah, I've done that already.
And two, meet the T-Rex.
Which I've done.
And okay, you've played Tomb Raider now, so yeah. That's all you need to do. Is really, that's all everyone remembers. If you can remember anything else about those first couple of games, I challenge you.
I think they're lying if they, oh, you remember that bit? No.
Like, I'm not going to go back and play this. I tried playing them when I was young, and I was like, yeah, these have dated. And, like, it's fine to have them remastered and people love them revisit. But, like, yeah. I don't, you know, we've got a lot better versions of these games since, whether they are Tomb Raider games like the Crystal Dynamics ones, which were amazing, or Uncharted, which is superior.
Like, I had a fun time where, you know, I sort of associate an older game almost being easier just because it's primitive's the wrong word, but, you know, it is an early version of what we've all sort of
come to. It was the first game of its kind, really.
Yeah, exactly. And enjoyment to be found when, you know, you've sort of cleared an area, you've solved a puzzle, and it's like, okay, how can I actually leave this area? Where do I need to platform to? What sort of enemies do I need to dispatch next and stuff? And once you actually get into the flow of how Lara is meant to control using those tank controls, it is fun. I'm still trying to find how I can appreciate those old games.
I think it's really
telling. Appreciate what they inspired, right?
Yeah.
I think it's really telling that none of the games that are inspired by it control like it, though.
I mean, yeah, like they wouldn't be able to, right?
No. One game that does control very nicely indeed, though, is Helldivers 2. We spoke about this last week because me, Jesse, and Matt have been playing it for a bit. But Jesse, you've been diving deeper into hell.
It was you
this
that
week.
Freed one of the sectors as well, single-handedly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've a war machine.
Super Earth, democracy, all that sort of stuff.
Sadly, I've been busy playing other things and doing other things this week, so I just haven't been able to play much Helldivers, which is a shame because I did want to play more. But Jesse, like I said, you've put hours into this and you're still having a blast, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting to have another co-op game that feels like it can be a very good co-op game. Baldur's Gate 3 was exactly that. And now we have this, which is a completely different kind of game. But... Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've sort of delved into a community regarding a game and actually had a really, really positive experience where I think we mentioned this last time, but when you're playing Helldivers, you're presented with this sort of like galactic map and you have two fronts at the moment and they're constantly changing and, you know, evolving as more players maybe fight on one particular planet to get rid of the bugs and other players, you know, are falling back to like the robot planets and dealing with them. And there's this clear distinction between Starship Troopers like enjoyment and satire when you're dealing with the bugs compared to like what is like Robo Vietnam and hell when you're dealing
There's a lot of TikToks that are about this contrast. Yeah.
And it's really, really fun because that clear divide between the community where they still like, you know, intersect and work together. But it's weird because you're almost getting two different experiences. Like me and all my mates, we've been playing solely on the robot planets because we want to try and contribute to like that war effort and having fun dealing with that whilst all the other people like having, you know, a lovely time just raining down artillery fire
on
all those
life.
Disgusting bugs. Yeah.
What happens when like a planet is fully like freed then? Does anything like special happen in game?
So I think only two planets from what I can remember, or maybe three planets have actually been secured so far for Super Earth and, you know, democratic reasons. But one of the main challenges, at least when you started the game with the bug planets, I can't remember what that sector was called, but when you captured those two planets, you got like a lot of different bits of currency and some other slight upgrades and stuff like that. So there is an incentive, and you always have a percentage tracker depending on what planet you're looking at. So when I was just looking at the Discord or Twitter or even Reddit, people like, okay, what planet do we need to focus on? Like, what was at 10% has now fallen down to 5%. We need to catch up. And it's weird because it's the first time I've messed around with a live service game that felt very positive in a way that I haven't really seen.
I mean, apart from, I've seen they've had a few like technical issues with matching and stuff, but apart from that, like, it seems to be everyone like pleasantly surprised by this game. And maybe it's partly because there's no real, I don't know, there was no hype cycle built up. It just kind of came out and everyone's like, oh, this is really fun. Let's enjoy it rather than spend time theorizing why it might not be good.
I saw a deal for a PS5 Slim that's only roughly about 400 quid, and I'm like, should I get it so I can play some Helldivers 2 with you boys? Is this the PlayStation exclusive that
That's what's really good as well, is that it's a good example of PlayStation releasing, or, you know, primarily the studio as well, obviously, releasing a game simultaneously on PC. And crossplay being a thing that could just like bring anyone together. My partner's playing on the PlayStation, I'm playing on PC, got mates playing on different things as well. And we can all just jump in. Like, the shooting feels really, really satisfying compared to any other third or even first person shooter I've played in a long time, where each gun feels distinctive. And when you're shooting the aliens or you're shooting the robots, there's not like numbers flying out of them. You're not really, as you're leveling up, upgrading like, oh, I've got, you know, this level 20 gun and now I can destroy everything. Like, some are armor piercing, some are like, you know, really good against like bugs specifically and stuff, but you're never feeling like I'm getting ahead of everyone completely. It's sort of like a level playing field.
It's never overwhelming, it's quite clean. I wrote a thing last week about this, of like how it's a studio historically doing what they do well, doing it very well. Like, Arrowhead have made co-op online games for their whole lifetime, basically, and now it's culminated in this really successful game. Yeah. Whereas a studio like Rocksteady tried doing a live service co-op online shooter with no actual experience doing that, and it's not turned out well comparatively. You should look at the numbers of people playing the games, and you can tell which one is doing it well and which one isn't. And it's just a lesson, like, let studios and let people make... Let them make what they want to make, but at the same time, make sure they have the experience to do that.
Yeah, like, that's kind of endemic to a lot of development as well. Like, you could say the same of Arcane previously with Redfall as well.
Exactly. Yeah. I wrote in my, I mean, the first example of this was Anthem, right? With BioWare going from story, some of the best written story RPGs to just Anthem, which no one played or wanted to play.
And that's the thing, I'll never be like, I don't want them to do this, you know, at all, because you have to have some...
No, because I really wanted to play Suicide Squad and I really want it to be good, but the proof's in the pudding, right?
Yeah, exactly. Always, like you just said, you know, the results speak for themselves. But with something like Helldivers 2, they released Helldivers, and that was like, what, 10 years ago or so, I think?
At least, yeah.
And they've just been working on this, and then they release it. And despite like some little, you know, niggling server issues, and maybe sometimes the game crashes and stuff, very, very rarely, like, I've put maybe, I don't know, I think 25 hours into the game, the game's crashed twice for me. Not a massive issue. And what's so good as well, that if that does happen and there's still a mission going where my partner and I are playing, if she's still alive, I could just drop right back in as soon as the game loads up. It's not like, oh, we have to wait till the mission's over and stuff. Like, it's amazing that a game like that
comes out.
Yeah, it just works. Like,
it is surprising how many games come out these days and don't work. So it almost feels like a miracle when this one isn't perfect by any means, technically wise, but it does work. So that is a bonus.
Much like democracy.
Exactly. I will say, if you're still like on the fence about it, we released a video yesterday, and I'm telling Aaron Horn here, but it's called Helldivers 2 Best Clips That Show Why the Game is Awesome. And it's just a ridiculous montage of shit blowing up, lasers flying across the screen. If you want to play something that's EDF, Starship Troopers, Warhammer, Terminator, just all meshed into one fantastic experience, like, check that video out, because it's just a fantastic montage of just ridiculous clips. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do want to play more. Hopefully, I'll find some time in the future.
People are thinking there's got to be another front at some point.
There's got to be. Well,
what happens when Super Earth gets, you know, taken over?
I wonder if they're having to accelerate things, because like we did not expect this many players, and they are freeing they are just putting democracy everywhere too quickly at the moment. We're going to need to build some new planets quick. But I'm sure they can just go, oh no, the aliens are back on one planet. So
they can fluff it, but. That's the thing. I don't know like how true to life the numbers are and stuff. There have been.
I'm sure they can.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But it's just, oh God, it feels good.
Yeah. Good stuff. One more game you've been dabbling in, Jesse. We can't keep you out of space. you've had a little go on the Dune expansion for Microsoft Flight Sim. Is this just a free expansion?
Yeah, it's just a free expansion. It's sort of similar to when Microsoft Flight Sim added, I think, the Pelican from Halo. And stuff, and they're always adding different little updates, you know, world updates and different tours you can do across Earth and stuff. But I am really enjoying the fact that we can get more ridiculous crossovers in Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Right, you know, it's in the name, right? Simulator. It's the most true to life simulator probably out there. It's the most realistic depiction of Earth and flying around Earth. And then they go, right, do you want to go to Arrakis in an ornithopter and fly around for a bit? It's like, yeah, sure.
I do actually. Yeah. Pretty sick.
It does look cool as well. I saw you your gameplay of it. I haven't had a chance to play it, but it does look like they got all the little animations of the ornithopter right and the sound as well.
It sounds so good. It's really, really fun to control. That's the thing. I played on PC, but I was, again, using an Xbox controller just because I've seen people online with very traditional flight sim setups being like, my Boeing setup doesn't work correctly for the ornithopter. And I was like, yeah, it's probably better to use a controller for this one because it's slightly more arcadey, just this specific example. But it's a free expansion you can just dive into. And if you have Game Pass, you can check it out. But it is a storm escape mission where you have to rescue like a fellow ornithopter, like pilot who's crashed. And then you have to sort of like escape from a dust storm. And then they've got a few other challenges, sort of like touch and go, where you're, you know, practicing your landing, then quickly race into other landing spots, all whilst exploring the version of Arrakis that they have put together.
Is their version of Arrakis just sat like desert with rocks in? Is that what it is? Because that is mainly kind what of, the planet
it's true. Is. Well, the thing is that you can't actually explore the map freely. You've got the set challenges and the tutorials that introduce you to the ornithopter. And, you know, you can go into like first person mode and, you know, click every little dial and whatnot. But that's the thing. It's got, I don't know, topography that's different to Earth and stuff like that.
It hasn't got the city in, right?
The city is there.
Oh, it is there. Okay, yeah. Cool.
The thing is, one of the challenges has you racing towards the city and you sort of land outside it, but you can see it. I haven't got close to it yet. But the main thing is that it's not like a massive, you know, expansion that you can really delve into. It is about maybe 5 or 6 missions. And the storm escape mission, you can watch the gameplay that we've put up on IGN, the storm escape mission, I'm just looking now, it took me, it's about 3 minutes long. The thing is, it will take you like an hour to do that one challenge because the timings are so, so precise. And if you get caught in the storm, you're dead. But it is, if you're just looking to hone in your skills and mess around for an hour or two, trying to perfect your times.
I'm in June for a bit, to be honest. What do you think a spice flavored Kit Kat would taste like? Like, I'm imagining spice tastes a little bit like a slightly, almost like a chili chocolate with a bit of an orange tinge.
I kind of always imagined like saffron or something like that.
Yeah. But how do you
like
use
a spicy
orange? How do you take spice?
Well, however you want, mate.
With a bit of tea, with a lemon.
Well, no, that's it. I can't remember what happens in the first film, but like, do they ever explain like how you, do you have to like snort spice? Or
do you huff spice? I don't know. It's mainly, I don't know if they actually just eat it. I think it's more just
a really
valuable thing, isn't
it? If you can put it over some steak or something, then like, you know, just have some spice flavored steak. I don't know. Hopefully it's delicious.
Are you going to become Spice Bay? No, just sprinkle spice over steaks.
No, that guy's a dickhead.
I can't imagine.
Come to my restaurant, Desert Power.
Is the Shai Halud in Microsoft Flight? I can't imagine that they programmed the fucking massive worm.
Don't have the big worms.
The thing is, come on. I haven't spotted it, but there has to be. There has to be an Easter egg somewhere where you see that worm. It'll be such a missed
opportunity. Or at least have like the sand rumbling under, like, you know, seeing one go like... that's easy enough, right? I don't know.
The worm has to be there. Someone will find it. But yeah. I did not see it because the, you know, terrifying dust wall, which is really, really impressive to look at, to be fair.
It's probably sand, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah. It's very impressive. So check it out for free.
I'm excited to see Dune, mate.
Well, next week.
Yeah.
Next week, maybe we will talk about it on the podcast, Dune Part 2. More Dune talk next week. We'll talk a lot about sand as well as other things. something you have been watching this week, though, Matthew Jones, is the new series of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, based on the hit Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie early 2000s film.
I think it was a hit, wasn't it?
I think it probably was a box office hit. I don't know if it's a good film.
I was going to say, before that film came out, was there any other previous Mr. and Mrs. Smith thing, or was that the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie film?
I think it was based on...
I was going to say, like, is it like a sort of secret massive IP that's based on a book that no one really knows about? Is there Mr. and Mrs. Smith lore that people... Is there a subreddit for it?
I don't know. Maybe it was an original thing. I don't know. All I know is that it was okay and it made a lot of money.
And I think
now they've made a TV
people,
series of it with Donald Glover in, which instantly makes everything better.
I think a lot of people have held on to that. Like, I think it's like, obviously the IP branding of like, oh, we recognize, you know, you hear Mr. and Mrs. Smith and you go like, oh, it's going to be spies or whatever. But you think, well, I've seen the movie. How is this going to be very different? And a lot of people have been holding
it's
that.
It's just a very... cool concept. It's a very like engaging thing of, right, this married couple are actually secretly spies or assassins, whichever. I can't remember if they're spies or assassins in the film, but is that the is it the same setup for the show?
It's very different, honestly. So I think the main thing in the film is that neither of the pair know that the other is a spy, so they're both independently just doing spy stuff, whereas this one they both very much know that they are spies.
Okay.
And so it's maybe a little spoiler for the first like 10-15 minutes of this show.
I'm sure that's fine.
It's very well presented as well. But they had never met before, so they're partnered up and they become like man and wife, husband and wife. That's the
a couple.
Yeah. No, it's actually very important that they're married before they ever.
Okay.
And so they're in this relationship. And had never met before, but as part of their spying, and one of them has a line of dialogue that's like, it's basically so that we'll keep tabs on each other, right? Like, we have to work as partners because it has an incentive for
us
to keep doing
this. They're spies
for
the same agency.
Yes. And importantly, neither of them know what the agency is. And they don't know really what mission, like they'll be given the mission, but they don't know why it's important, who any of the players are.
This is weirdly similar to a film idea I've had for 15 years that I've never written.
I hate it when that happens. Like, I could have done this.
Oh, no, Donald Glover did it first. It's different enough, but like,
yeah.
I'm never going to write it, so, you know.
So in that first episode, there's a lot of like people doing gig work in the background. Like, you know, a character will get an Uber, or there'll be like an Uber Eats thing happening. And it's trying to make this real, like, what if spy stuff was happening under a gig work economy? So, you know, basically getting an assassination done, like, by somebody who doesn't know, doesn't care the specifics of it, but they're just like, go here, do this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like really cool. All of that, like, you really don't know what's happening behind the scenes by design. But I think the thing that really sells it, I've been watching this with my partner, and the way that the two main characters will talk to each other feels like the way that people that are in a relationship will, like, decompress after something. Like, you'll have been out at a party, and then somebody will have said something weird, and then only, like, hours later, you'll be like, do you remember the time when they said that? Like, it feels really like the way that couples talk when really no one else is around.
Yeah.
And in a way that I've not seen reflected in basically anything before.
It takes Mr. and Mrs. Smith to have realistic relationship dialogue.
Like actual
is the tone similar to the film? Is it like an action comedy? Is that
is action, there's comedy, but I wouldn't say that it's very much like it at all. Like, to its detriment in its branding, I think that a lot of people have skipped this by going, it's probably like a little bit of a mid-movie, where I actually think it's really well written.
And it's crucially a TV series, which... has I haven't seen the full list, but it seems like an endless list of just ridiculous guest stars turning up in it.
So Paul Dano keeps showing up as well. Yes. John Turturro is in an episode. Mm-hmm.
Skarsgård pop up. He pops Skarsgård's up
like right at the beginning. Yeah, he's like they just got everybody. Yeah,
I do want to get around to this just because it does seem like it's good fun.
Are all the episodes out, or is it a weekly thing
of that first season? Oh, yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, it's a little 12 episode. I've not seen the final one yet, but it's very good.
I'm going to check it out. Cause it's always good to have something to watch while I'm playing Football Manager.
Oh, here we go. Wow.
I've just been on a real tear recently. I've already put in, God, I'm just looking at my Steam now, I've put 490 hours into Football Manager 2024.
That was just yesterday.
The game came out in November, so that's like 3 and a bit months. That's a lot of time. But I've been taking, I wanted a challenge, so I've taken Barnett up from the conference, what's it, whatever it's called now, the Vanarama National League or something, all the way up to the Premier League in 5 seasons.
It's not an impressive sound of back-to-back promotions.
Sorry?
Barnett, it just doesn't sound like an impressive
place. Have you not heard of Barnett?
No, I have. It's just like, it's just not, just sort of like an underwhelming name for a place.
All right, well, it's near enough for all this. Steady on. but yeah, once player coached by Edgar Davids of Dutch fame. Come on, have some respect.
You know, this just goes over our heads entirely.
Yeah, but I'm looking you in the eyes while I'm saying it. No, that's fair. It's got back-to-back-to-back promotions and it's just gone really well for me. I'm really thrilled. I might be on the cusp of a Premier League victory already, like 8 seasons in.
So. You know what I want to know? You've put so many hours into this series. Is it at all challenging when you're playing? Like
sometimes, yeah. I mean, I feel like this, the last year or two, it's for some reason, I don't know if I've cracked the code, which it seems easier than normal. I just seem to be able to like win.
You're a god.
Do you think you could go pro actually now? Based off this?
Do you know what? I wouldn't put it past me. But I don't know, I've just kind of nailed it. I haven't actually... So yesterday, an exploit was found, a really bad one in the game that they need to desperately patch out, which I haven't actually... I tested it out just to see if it actually works,
of course,
and it does.
Yeah, just to
test.
But
basically, you can get a bid accepted for any player in the world. So whether they cost, I don't know, £300 million is how much they cost. There's this exploit where you can basically get them for 2.5 million if you put in the exact right offer of like installment amounts and percentages. And means you can basically get a bid accepted for 2.5 million for any player in the world, which does break the game, but I've got not done it this time. What I might do is start a new random save with a really rich club and just buy it, like just create an absolutely ridiculous dream team and see what happens. But yeah, that's quite bad.
How far can, this is me with no football knowledge at all, how far can you go to just like absorb the world of every football player and just like, can you have like, just one conglomerate
you
only football
really
team.
Can have a, you don't really have a squad of like 25.
But you
players.
Can't you can't like just buy out like 500 reserve players and just fuck over every
other
team.
You'd never have the budget for that.
Damn it.
No. Unless but I'm sure you could edit the database and really cheat it to be like that. But
I was going
to
say, if you had infinite money, could you just fuck over the
every
football
player,
economy?
Every possible player.
I mean, that's
player.
Pretty much what I did in my last career where I took over Aston Villa and I won. I think I've got like 17 league titles in a row and I just have to bet there's no point in me signing players. There's no one that would even get on my bench I can sign. It's pointless. So yeah, I'm kind of, I don't know.
But what would, I just theoretically here, let's say you buy every person that plays football in the world and the rest of the teams can't even fill a team. Do you automatically win because they have to
I just
want to
know what happens. Like what's the fail state?
I mean,
the
it would be impossible to sign the however hundred thousands of players.
Somebody should like mod it in.
You'd be playing that. It would generate just like what it normally does. It's just generate fake players who like would fill the squad, but there'd be like 16-year-olds who are awful and stuff like that. So it would be
broke 16-year-olds and no team. Yeah.
Let's say it from the opposite side though. Let's say that you have no active players in your roster. Yeah. You can't play any games, right? Like it will just forfeit whatever you're.
I can't remember the last time that happened to me. I couldn't fill a bench, but like I think it does. Yeah, like you'd have to bring up like people from the under-17s, under-18s, and then it would maybe create fake players. I can't remember.
That's pretty
funny. Such an absurdly rare scenario to happen that maybe I should test all these things out. But I mainly just wanted to do that to just as a little segue to say that Sunderland Till I Die is back, the Netflix documentary that follows Sunderland Football Club. It was one of the first real football documentaries that did it right, I think. It first came out, when was the first series? Like 5-6 years ago, I think. And 2018 it was, so yeah, just over 5 years ago. And it followed Sunderland, who, if you don't know, had a real... They were in the Premier League, and then they kind of... They got relegated to the Championship, and the first season followed that. And it was meant to be like... Sunderland's big resurgence back into the Premier League. What no one saw coming was that they got straight relegated again into League One, which is below the Championship. And it just made for a season of television where you basically, it was just pure misery the whole time. The club was being run terribly. And the key to Sunderland tie-dye was they put as much focus on the football as they did, even more focus, I'd say, on the fans. Who, like, Sunderland is such a town that's centred around the football team, a city even that's centred around the football team. And kind of when the club doesn't do well, the city doesn't do well. And it really followed that. It's kind of like, it was almost like the un-Hollywood version of Wrexham. Of the Wrexham one.
That's what I wanted to ask, like, why Sunderland? And, like, does the documentary, because I'm trying to understand the perspective, like, it's not, it doesn't, like, does it blow smoke? Does it blow up smoke?
No,
like,
I don't think, I think that's what's good about the Sunderland one, is it doesn't really paint over any of it too much. It shows it like it is. There's some funny moments in the first couple of series where the owners are just, like, trying to pick, like, new music for the team to walk out to, and they just pick this really bad EDM and stuff. It's just like, there's funny moments, but it's also, it's like a lot of sad moments as well. And I think they pit Sunderland because they are such a massive club that fell on hard times, basically. And the first two seasons were following basically the decline, and it was all like misery. But then they've come back a couple of years later and released just 3 episodes in this last season to kind of cap it all off, because I think to give more of a happy ending. And it's not quite as good as it once was, but they still do the good thing of focusing on the fans. And it has a really good, heartwarming, yet also heartbreaking ending to it. That's really, like, they really, I think, nailed the ending of it and show what the whole series was about. And I'd encourage, like, it's a good entry into, and see why football matters so much to some people, because, like, especially the people in that documentary, like, it's their lives, basically, and it's really worth watching. But yeah, I enjoyed those last 3 episodes, and it hit the spot.
I wouldn't mind checking out. Like, where can you actually?
It's
watch
on Netflix.
It? Oh, okay, cool. Because that's the thing. Like, I'll never enjoy or appreciate the sport.
Check out football if you get the chance.
Yeah, I know. but if there's something that can introduce, you know, the actual players and how it, you know, the fans and how it affects them.
I think that's what the larger story does well. It's kind of like the, like I said, the less glossy version of the Wrexham one, the actual more true to life. Not that I think the Wrexham one's too bad in that regard, but it does.
I stopped watching it. It just felt a bit like,
No, Sunderland tie-dye was, in my eyes anyway, the best one version of these. So yeah, I'd check that out. What else have we got? I suppose we've got some feedback to go to. IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com. Let us know. Next week we'll be talking about Dune. Maybe we'll talk a bit about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I don't know. Any questions about two of those things? Maybe write in and let us know. IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com.
What's your favourite desert?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's your favourite sand planet?
And Kit Kat. What's the best Kit Kat variety? Oh, that's two finger, four finger, chunky.
Speaking of Kit Kats, we're probably going to take a break.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Snap. Those are the fingers of the Kit Kat breaking. And we're back. Again, let us know what your favourite Kit Kat is. IGN underscore UK feedback at IGN.com. Just like we've got a couple this week about... I don't even know if we put the call out, but people have been contributing to their favourite either kids TV shows or game shows from basically the late 90s, early 2000s. And we've got a couple of... suggestions, a couple of favorites here. Matt, you've got the first one.
I do. I want to say as well, I was listening to last week's episode. I was a big fan of Crossfire, whoever emailed in about that.
I do need to, I still haven't watched it's so got to be on YouTube. Fun. I've got to watch them.
Like, it's a paintball show, but it's so, like, the in-between stuff is really funny. The, like, framing and, like, the, yeah, getting money to have better equipment is just, like, when you were watching, you were like, oh, I want to do that. I want to play a game that's like this. And then you discover Counter-Strike. Like that, I think I was genuinely interested in playing Counter-Strike because of Crossfire.
Anyway,
so this one's from Andrew Priest, who says, "Hi, IGN crew. Hope all is well. Listening to last week's pod and hearing Cardi mention Funhouse got me thinking of another kids' game show from yesteryear. I don't know if you young whippersnappers in IGN towers are too young to remember this game show. I assure you, the majority of us
definitely
are not too young. Maybe Jesse." There was a show on CITV once called Nightmare. It basically involved a team of four young lads and then subjected them to what I would say was the single most difficult game show in television history. I don't remember anyone ever winning it. And I would sit there watching and thinking, how the fuck are you supposed to complete this? Yeah, Jesse, is this ringing any bells?
I've never heard of it.
Oh, you'd before. Love Nightmare. Yeah. If that was on now, you'd be on it. You would have loved it.
Well, I'll give you a little bit more description from Andrew here. It says, one of the four lads would put on a ridiculous helmet so he couldn't see a thing, and the other three lads had to guide him through a virtual reality medieval dungeon filled with monsters, traps, and puzzles, while the bearded host of the show would make disparaging remarks throughout. You only got one life, too. If the blindfold kid gets killed, that's it. Game over. I don't know if I necessarily want it back. I was more curious if anyone remembers it. And that's from Andrew.
It's the like the ultimate Steve. Co-op game show, Jesse. You would have loved it. So it was a co-op game. Basically, one kid was blinded, sent to their death, and you had to rely on your friends to not
that
kill you.
Jokes.
So, Andrew, they did very briefly bring it back for a single video for YouTube Rewind, I think in 2013. Jesus. A friend of the show worked on the production of it. So there is, it's starring Izzy City from Peep Show as one of the hosts. So if you want to see what Nightmare would be like now, there's an hour-long special that you can watch on YouTube.
I mean, I was too young for it when it originally... There was actually a late 80s, early 90s thing, I think. But I definitely watched reruns when it was when I was younger.
I'm just looking at it now, and it does look like a fixed camera angle slash matte painting maze where kids are subjected to, like...
Oh, it's basically on a green screen, yeah. I'd watch it. It's fun. There's definitely, there's got to be like some highlight reel compilations out there of hilarious things happening. It was terrifying as well, because like as you lost your life or like you took too long, like this skull would peel away and like there would be like snakes in its eyes, if I remember rightly, and stuff like that, and just horrible stuff happening. Quite terrifying for kids, actually. But yeah, I think you'd enjoy Nightmare. There's like over 100 episodes of it, I think, so... Yeah, there you go. It's one for you, Jesse. I've got an email from Daniel Tate. He says, "Hi all, following on from your conversation about old kids shows, I thought I'd write in with one I remember, but no one I know remembers. It was the early 2000s on CBBC. A bunch of Scottish kids in a found footage sort of style. And it was called Jeopardy, and it was about these Scottish kids on a school trip to Australia and was about alien abduction. Was mint. On another note, don't know if you've seen this, but the producer of Lost have made a show called From. Has the actor who plays Michael from Lost in it. And it's along the same lines. A mysterious place where more questions than answers are offered. But very good. Keep up the good work. And of course, respect the sea. I haven't heard of From, but I have heard of Jeopardy. I do remember watching Jeopardy as a kid. And I do, that would have come out when I was like 10 or 11 or something, I think. And I do remember it being quite scary. I don't know if kids, it's probably just because I don't watch kids' TV these days, isn't it? But I do remember when I was younger, kids' TV being actually quite scary at times. Like you had your Demon Headmasters and stuff like that, which were terrifying. Like, do kids these days have an equivalent scary television? I don't know.
I don't know, but they've got fucking Bluey, and that's rad.
What did you like? Because you're like the generation before me and Matt slightly here, Jesse. What was your like? Do you have like a series that stuck out?
I mean, what came to mind immediately was Brainiac. Don't know if you guys ever watched.
I watched that. Brainiac. Yeah, that was like, on Sky, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I remember watching, I think it was called Brainiac Science Abuse, and it was sort of like a Mythbusters for kind of
kids. Oh, I remember
kids,
the one you mean now, yeah.
I guess.
Was that the Richard Hammond one?
Yeah, it was Richard Hammond. And as a kid, I always thought that was just David Tennant. I always mix those two up. But I was just revisiting the first episode today, actually, just to see. One of the experiments, which I think has aged fairly poorly, I don't know who would have greenlit this, is that there's one guy on a bike with a heart rate monitor, and another guy is sitting on a couch, and he has two topless ladies in front of him, and the experiment is just whose heart rate is faster.
Yeah, was that a kid show?
It was definitely
a kid show.
It was on the pre-watershed stuff as well.
I don't know if Brainiac was a kid show. Wasn't it more of like a teen, like
it was pre-watershed? So you know, everything's.
I don't know.
I remember watching it early in the morning, but I was just like, that's aged.
I remember an episode as well where I think it's John Tickle, which I also think it's hilarious.
That's an awful name.
His thing was that he was on Big Brother and he was sort of clever, so he managed to get on this show. But he was doing a little bit that was about like if you drink more beer at a lower alcohol percentage, does it get like does it mean that you don't get a hangover? I was like, I'm like 11.
Yeah. This is great knowledge. Yeah. Jesus. But yeah, Brainiac Science Abuse was something I remember watching a decent amount of. I don't remember the topless people and the heart rate monitor experiment. Maybe I'll skip that episode.
I don't think this is a kid show. I think you're misremembering. But who knows? You could watch it when you're a kid. That's fine. There we go. And stuff. We still want more of that. We want Kit Kats and best maybe scary kids TV shows. Let's pivot to that. I'm sure the Demon Headmaster will be at the top of a lot of people's list. Did you ever watch that, Jesse, or were you too
what show
young?
Sorry,
the Demon Headmaster. Sadly the actor died I think last year or the year before.
I'm not familiar.
Terrifying if you were my age.
The thumbnail's awful. It's got a sort of similar vibe to the Goosebumps intro. It's just a bunch of weird effects and stuff. It's terrifying.
For me, that was the peak, and it's probably because it was when I was like at peak child age to be watching this stuff. But that, The Queen's Nose, and Bernard's Watch, those were your
go-tos. Do you remember Aquila?
I do remember Aquila.
I've got this haunting memory of Aquila where there's an episode where they like have programmed Aquila to show up if they blow a whistle, but they can't remember if they programmed it to be on the left or right. So he's like, Aquila's going to kill me. Aquila's going to like run into me. And I was like, yeah, God, what if you did just forget if you've programmed your mythical Roman machine?
What a mad concept. Yeah. You don't make them like that anymore.
I was going to say, like, you two must know this show. And I can't remember the bloody name for it, but I think it was a Scottish BBC show. This guy wore like this sort of black, almost Raven? Game of Thrones. Yeah, it was Raven. That's it. God, yeah. That was
we know him in real life.
Good man.
Yeah.
What?
We don't actually know him. We know a lad who looks quite a lot like him. Oh, we'll leave it at that.
Sad. But yeah, Raven was bloody sick, man. It was just, wouldn't you say, like, just let the challenge begin? It was the hypest thing. Oh, God.
Yeah. And we haven't even got time to talk about how good Zap was. But anyway, let's talk about that another day.
Shout out to Alex Mack as well. That was a big one for me.
Another great episode of the IGN UK podcast. Oh, what are we going to have for music this time?
I mean, is the theme to Raven any good?
Why
I don't
are we
remember
going
it.
With Raven?
I don't know. Like, it must be good.
Could I have It's Going Down from the Persona 3 Reload soundtrack, actually?
I was going
to
suggest that. We can't talk about Persona and not have Persona music on. So, yeah, we're gonna go with that. But thank you for your suggestion of the Raven theme, Jesse.
I can't remember what it sounds like.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, see ya. Goodbye.
Bye, bye, bye.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.